So at this time, I see our very first facilitator and speaker who's getting ready to start. So as Alexis, I get ready to transition over to the materials. I'll call those up. And it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to you, Alexis, to officially begin the session.
Thank you so much, Jean. Hi, welcome everybody. Wow, I see we have almost 170 folks on the line. We're so glad to have you here. Thanks for taking the time to hear about this playbook and how to kind of apply this playbook to working with contaminated sites in your rural downtown. This playbook, as you probably know, because you signed up for this webinar, provides practical steps to organize a local team with the right mix of skills that are going to let you reimagine, initiate, and attract investment back to rural downtowns. And you'll hear along the way some stories about how that gets those strategies have been applied in real places around the country. But before we move on, we want to hear where you're from. So we have one of our polls, as Jean mentioned, and we'd love to start by hearing where you all are located. I think this poll works. You can either click on, you can see on the map there which states are covered. We have the map that organizes EPA re states into, I'm sorry, that organizes the country into regions that have the following states and territories. And then we know that some folks are calling in or joining us from outside the United States. So if that's the case, please feel free to put the country that you're calling from or that you're joining us from in the question and answers. We would love to know. That's really exciting. So go ahead
All
and
right.
participate in that poll.
Thank you, Alexis. It looks like almost three quarters of the audience have voted, and I think
Okay.
they're getting the hand of it right now. So I'm going to go ahead and close the poll down here in noting that we do have a handful. We have someone on from Belgium, which is exciting. We do have an international
I was
audience.
born in Belgium, so I'm like, that's extra exciting for me. Okay, wow.
All right. So looking at this, it does look like we have a wonderful distribution across the US, with the largest groups coming in from Region 5 and Region 3 and Region 7.
Nice. Great. Thank you. With that, we will move on. Thank you all for joining us. It's great to get such a good spread around the country. Now that we know at least where you all are coming from, we want to introduce you to some of our presenters for the webinar. So if we'll go to the next slide, I can tell you a little bit about who you're going to meet today. Okay, so first, my name is Alexis Rourke-Reyes. I'm one of the moderators with Jean and with Amy. I work at the US EPA, the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. So work on a program called the Superfund Redevelopment Program, which tries to provide long impacted communities with new opportunities to grow and prosper. And I am joined by my partner in crime, Amy Storm. She is in the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization at EPA. She's the EPA's Land Revitalization Coordinator within the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. Her work supports community-led redevelopment of contaminated properties and associated neighborhood revitalization strategies. Next, we have a few folks from not from EPA, and we are so happy to have them here and be able to highlight their work. We have Ruthie Caldwell, one of the co-authors of the investment playbook, as well as the owner of Vision Granted. I love that name. A grant writing, project management, and facilitation consulting agency based in Eastern Kentucky, which specializes in community and economic development. She's joined by Melissa Levy, who's also a co-author of the playbook. And Melissa is the principal of Community Roots. It's a rural community and economic development consulting firm. She's been doing this work for over 20 years, working with federal, state, and local governments, nonprofits, foundations, and citizens groups in natural resource-based industries, which include things like agriculture, forestry, tourist, recreation, and also creative economies. Then we also have Shane Barton from the University of Kentucky and the Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky. He serves as the Downtown Revitalization Coordinator. Shane has a long-term commitment to inclusive and representative community development strategies with a particular focus on rural communities. Following Shane, we will get to hear from Ray Moeller. And Ray, I apologize, I did not memorize all these bios, but there's such great things. I want to make sure I get them right. Ray comes to us from West Virginia University. He's one of the key people that was interviewed for this investment playbook, and he provided information and case studies about successful downtown revitalization projects that use brownfields. And he currently works in the Brownfields Assistance Center at West Virginia University and provides on-the-ground support for the statewide downtown redevelopment. Last but not least, we have another friend from EPA, not from headquarters like Amy and I. Tom is from EPA Region 5, where I saw a number of people here are also from, based in Chicago, Illinois. Tom is the Region 5 Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator. And he's been working with communities in his region, which is in some of the states in the Midwest, since the inception of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative over 20 years ago, almost 25 years ago. And he's worked with nearly 100 communities in this region to consider reuse as part of the cleanup process. So, with that, I think I will turn it over to my co-moderator, Amy, to hear a little bit more about the connection of why EPA really wanted to share this resource with you. Thanks.
Thanks, Alexis. Hi, everybody. I'm so happy that you could all be here today too. And just to before we dive into the playbook, I wanted to give you all a little context. So this playbook that we're talking about today is not an EPA resource. It was actually commissioned by the Appalachians Funders Network and Central Appalachian Network. Ruthie and Melissa will talk more about the origins of the playbook. But at EPA, we ran across this a little over a year ago, and I really appreciate this resource and want it to be shared widely. So I'm glad that you could all come today and spend time with us to learn about it. I feel like this playbook really takes a lot of the mystery out of some of the, deep challenges that come with revitalizing small and rural downtown areas. And so it describes how to bring the local team together and how you can identify assets in your community that can serve as catalysts. So I really appreciate the strategic approach. And as you'll see as they go through it today, also, making it as accessible as possible. So I hope that you enjoy learning about it with us. I have a couple more things I want to share. Why does EPA care? The programs that Alexis works for, the Superfund Redevelopment, and my work with the Brownfields Land Revitalization work at EPA, we are all about wanting to help communities safely reuse contaminated or potentially contaminated properties. And that's a public safety issue, but there's also so many other benefits that come from getting these sites addressed and cleaned up if needed, both with the public health, the environmental improvement, and of course, a lot of significant improvements to the local economy when this happens. So we wanted to make sure you had that connection to why it's important to us that communities are empowered to safely redevelop contaminated properties. So this playbook, I think, is especially relevant when dealing with contaminated properties. Your downtown may have properties that are or might be contaminated, and that's really bringing things down in your community. And figuring out how your community wants to reuse one or more of these sites in your downtown is really vital to making decisions about how the site is addressed in terms of how it gets assessed, how it gets remediated, and how it gets reused over the long term so that it can be reused safely. So all of these things we're really excited about sharing. And with that, Ruthie, thanks for coming on. I will turn it to you.
Awesome. Hey, thanks, Amy. So yeah, I got to be one of the authors for the playbook, and oh, I will change the slide myself. Okay. So here's the team for the playbook. And just as a little bit of background, I'm a grant writer based out in Eastern Kentucky, and I just noticed that there were so many really cool old properties that were kind of dilapidated that could really be transformed into new things, right? And I serve a lot of very disadvantaged nonprofits, very disadvantaged communities, and a lot of times folks would see these great properties that were just kind of scary to have to redo, right? It was going to cost a lot of money. There was no single grant that could pay for it. And so I was just wondering, like, what other types of funding and financing can be put together to help pay for these really cool projects that could really help move a town forward? So when I was, I found out about this opportunity to get to make this playbook, the Appalachian Funders Network, Center Appalachia Network, Downtown Appalachia, and Invest Appalachia were all coming together, and they were really trying to find ways to help solve some of these problems, right? Help people know how to speak the language of investment and how to stack different types of money together to pay for things. So Barbara Wyckoff with Creative Disruptors, Melissa Levy of Community Roots, and Robert Donnan from Donnan Consulting, we all worked together and we started performing interviews all over Appalachia, all over America. And we started doing surveys and reviewing different literature to find out what are these problems that are keeping people back from being able to, you know, redo some of these properties. And we found out that there were a lot of investment challenges. We found out that there were also just challenges because investors and funders were not speaking the same language as the people on the ground who were trying to do the work. So they were not able to get the money to do it. So really there needed to be some sort of roadmap that could help communities and investors both come together and not just focus on one type of funding, but really be able to stack different types together to revitalize these downtowns. So, ta-da, the playbook was created. And so it started out as a PDF. And then recently, there's a new version online. You can go to downtownplaybook.org and you can look it on your phone. It's a nice little website. It's very interactive. And so this playbook can be a PDF that you download and share, or you can use the website. And inside the playbook, it talks about all kinds of different ways that you can fund and finance different projects. And so when I say funding, I mean money that you don't have to pay back. And when I say financing, I mean money that you do have to pay back. So this was just a playbook that shows all the key players that you're going to need to have involved in the project. We were able to come up with a community assessment so that you can actually go online right after this, take that assessment and see what types of investments your community is ready for right now. Then we are also able to find out ways that can help groups organize for investment and then different types of investment strategies. And we got to do a lot of really cool case studies. So I highly encourage you to go to the website and look through some of those. It's really inspiring to see all of these small rural towns that have been able to really make a difference and fund these dreams that they had to revitalize their downtowns. All right, so here's the first part of the playbook. Anytime you have a playbook, you've got to have the key players, right? So you've got to know who you have to have at the table to get this to move forward and to win. And so these were the five different types of organizations or key players that we found you really need to have to start getting that momentum. And I know that lots of rural towns are very small, and so you might have one person doing all of these, and that is okay. It is better if you can have a few more than one person, but some of these might be multiple people as well or multiple organizations. You just have to make sure at least one organization or person is filling each of these roles to really help get some momentum. So the first thing that you need to have on your team, first key player, is a spotter. And so this is the person who is the visionary, who like really sees that contaminated property or building. And they're like, I know what that could be. And they can see that vision for it. And the next is a framer. This is the deal maker. This is the organization or the person who can really see, okay, here's a bunch of different types of funding we can put together to make this work. And here's how we're going to connect all the different people and get this deal happening. And then the next is the engager. So you really need to have someone who can help build trust in the community. You need to have someone who can really help get the local government and the people on the same page and share that vision. And the next is a developer, and the developer is the risk taker. And some of the projects like you'll see today might have more than one developer. And this is usually someone or an organization who's willing to take on the risk of investing in that property. So it might be someone who has a business who wants to go into that property. It might be a local government. There's all kinds of organizations that could take on that risk for developing that property. And then finally, One that lots of people don't think about is having a primary contact. So this is the person who wakes up every day thinking about this project that someone can call along throughout the project, and they'll know where the project is, what stage, what's happening, and be able to share that with people. And really, you just have to have one person who's super responsive to emails and is, you know, ready to talk about the project at any time. So those are the five key players. And so let's take a poll. So I want you to think of a community you're working with right now. Which key players are missing? So you can check all that apply if you have more than one that's missing. But which one is missing from your team? The spotter, the framer, the engager, the developer, the primary contact?
And just a quick gentle reminder for anyone who can't see that poll, sometimes it gets hidden under the three dots or more menu on your device. But if it's not there, you can always share your responses by just writing them into an answer in the Q&A, and you can submit that on in. Ruthie, it looks like about a third of the audience has responded. They're thinking about it, and the answers are coming in. There's definitely a clear leader here on what seems to be missing from the communities. But I'll encourage everyone to go ahead and just take a quick moment here to think, and then checking off, as Ruthie said, all that might apply to your situation and hitting that blue submit button. Again, for anyone who cannot see the poll, you can just type in from the answers you see in the pink boxes what might be missing in a community that you are working with. All right, it looks like about half of them responded. So I'm going to go ahead and close this poll now in 3, 2, 1, and let's look. All right, so by far, it looked like about 60% or more indicated that they're missing a developer. That was the clear winner in most communities. But we do see many indicating about a third saying they're missing a framer and engager, and then also a lot also missing that spotter or even a primary contact.
I am really not surprised. The developer is the risk taker, and it is very hard to want to take risk. So hopefully this presentation will help you be able to figure out ways that you can reuse the property and be able to help recruit that developer to your team. All right. So there's other people you might want on your team in addition to those key players. You know, sometimes you have to get some pre-work done before you even get started. You might need someone who knows about historical preservation if it's a historical site, or people who can help with engineering and architecture, research studies to make sure the concept is feasible, but also just thinking creatively about who else in your community might want to get involved, who else in your region might want to get involved. Do you need a health center? Do you need a library? Do you want to get the local government involved? Could this be a place to house local government? Or some other really cool projects that I've seen done actually were instigated by universities and colleges. A lot of times they have a lot of capacity and students that want to get involved in the community. And so they can do some really cool projects whenever they work with their community to revitalize some of these properties. So there's a list of some that you might want to think about. So you'll want to start getting the community involved. And one of the first things that you can do with some of those key players is take that investment readiness assessment together. It doesn't take very long. You can sit down and have a meeting and do that together as a group. And you can click on this if you want to get this afterwards, or you can go to that website and take that. And then there's some other ways to get community partners involved. So I am going to let Alexis take over and share some of that.
Thanks, Ruthie. Yeah, I just wanted to mention, and for those people that are joining that do have a Superfund site in their community, we wanted to let you know that the ways to kind of carry out this same strategy in terms of involving community partners are already built into the Superfund process. And so there are a couple things that will happen as part of that process. One is called the Superfund Community Involvement Plan, where you have somebody that's assigned to that site to be the coordinator of community involvement throughout the process. And they'll really want to get to know your community really well and understand which of the organizations and individuals that are interested in staying informed and contributing to reuse and redevelopment, and also just staying informed in general about the cleanup process. There's another activity that is part of all Superfund site processes called the Site Reuse Assessment. And that's where folks from EPA or their partners in the states decide how they're going to clean up one of these sites. They do take into account what the future land use might be for that site. And so it's a really great time to get engaged with the folks that are working on the cleanup process so that they can be aware of what your goals for a particular site might be, what needs the community has, what opportunities it has, what assets do you have to build on. And so those are two kind of mandatory parts. And when you get the slides later, you can click on those and kind of learn more. And then we also support communities that maybe didn't miss those opportunities, or I'm sorry, didn't get involved at the initiation of the Superfund process, but still have thoughts about what they want to do for reuse in their community. And so we support reuse planning all over the country. We have about 50 projects going on, and it's as easy as contacting your EPA site team for your Superfund site, and they can and let them know that you want to have some support on reuse planning, and we can take it from there. And I will pass it over to Amy because I know she has some similar activities that go on the brownfield side.
Absolutely. Thanks, Alexis. Yes, for those of you who are dealing with brownfield sites, if you have a grant or work with an organization that has a grant to assess those brownfield sites, we want to make sure that you know that there are many planning activities that are eligible under those assessment grants and multi-purpose grants, if you have that kind of grant. And I will send Jean the link so you guys can have that at your disposal and you can learn about those. Those are great ways to include the community in site reuse planning activities. And as you're thinking through what are the opportunities here that my community is interested in for reuse, as what at the same time while you're learning about the environmental conditions of the property, what the infrastructure is, what the market will support, and all those important factors that help lead to successful reuse. So lots of opportunities here to get involved in site reuse planning and polling your community partners. So I will now turn it to Melissa to keep us going.
Sorry. Great. Thank you. I am going to move us along. I'm really excited to be here. I'm going to talk to you. We talked about some of the key partners that are critical to investment in rural downtown revitalization. But how do you find the right partners? Not every partner is the right partner. And so one way to think about this is to think about the outcomes you're seeking by revitalizing your downtown. So there are impacts, obviously, on built capital through the buildings and infrastructure on which you're working. We hope that there's some financial capital built, probably social capital and bringing people together for the project and also in the downtown, and maybe some cultural capital in terms of building on the arts and culture and in a place. So who else is interested in these outcomes? That's one question to ask. And as you're thinking about potential partners, trying to understand what their value proposition is for engaging, how do your hoped for outcomes connect with what they're looking for? So those are just some different ways of thinking about partners beyond the kind of the functions that we talked about before. And then also, you know, in terms of value propositions, when I think of value propositions, I'm thinking of three different levels. One is pure self-interest, which is fine. So, you know, what's in it for the partners in this, you know, in a particular project? Like, what do they get out of it? Is it worth their while? But there's also shared interest. What's in it for us together, for me and you? There may be something that both you and I value in a particular project. And then finally, there's common interest. What's in it for everyone, for the community, for the region? Common interests often stimulate outside investment and effective marketing messages. So just some thinking around value propositions there. And then, you know, we talked about the readiness assessment. This was a really is a piece of the playbook that I feel like people really connect with. It has some value in terms of understanding what kinds of assets you already have. And it helps communities know if they're ready for investment, and if so, what kinds. It also helps investors know which communities are ready for investment. So these readiness factors kind of signal to investors that there are the conditions necessary for success in rural communities. And we've broken these into a variety of kind of areas. You can see here, community assets are really, it's really about partners, leadership, capacity, kind of planning and shared priorities, and different kinds of engagement. Then we've got local government and civic structures. This is really about like what kinds of local government agencies and partners do you have in place? Is there a downtown group? Is there marketing capacity in your community? The economic ecosystem is really about demand, right? Is there demand for what you're proposing in your downtown? Is there a workforce? Is there education in place? Is it a business-friendly environment? Are there networking opportunities and buy local kinds of campaigns, things like that? And then the built infrastructure is pretty straightforward, right? We're talking about built infrastructure, but is there infrastructure that's going to support what you're looking to do? Is there broadband? Are the roads and the lighting in a good place? Is there walkability? Is there parking? Is there housing? And is it nearby? Is it affordable? So there's a variety of built infrastructure you can be thinking about. And then the natural environment, what kinds of natural assets are in and around your downtown? Are there other green spaces that connect to downtown? Are there recreation opportunities, any protected and maintained lands that you can connect? So these are just some of the things that are part of this assessment. I know that the link, I think, was shared. And then we have a poll. So thinking back about that community that we thought about before, what's their greatest strength in your mind? And you can check all that apply.
Yes, just like you were saying, Melissa, we're going to wait for some of those responses. And I do really encourage everyone just to take a moment and share your input, because as you respond to these polls and thoughtfully kind of walk through what our presenters are sharing, it also helps them tailor the conversation as we move forward in today's webinar. So it looks like right now about a quarter of the audience has responded. For anyone who can't see that poll window, that is perfectly okay to look at the options that are on the right side of the screen on that slide. And if you can't see the poll window, just review what's on the slide. And you can feel free to pick from those options on the right of the slide and manually type them into a response in the Q&A. It looks like almost half of the audience has shared their responses into the Q&A right now. Into the poll window, I apologize. So I'm going to give everyone just a second or two longer to think through. And remember, there's no penalty for a wrong response. You will not get graded on your answer here today, ladies and gentlemen. So right now, what I'm going to do is go ahead and close the poll out here in 3, 2, 1. And let's take a look at those responses. Now, it does look as though community assets and natural environment were the two leading responses, but local government and civic structures also were pretty strong in about a third of the answers. But we did see some people indicating also is that economic ecosystems and build infrastructure are also strengths in some communities.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. So now you can... Obviously, this assessment goes deeper than that survey, but the great thing is you can actually do it, and it actually will send you a score, I think, to your email with like kind of where your strengths are and where you can do more. The idea is to understand what kinds of investments in your community ready for now. And what can you do to help your community become ready for bigger investments? What we found is the secret sauce for making these kinds of investments that catalyze other investments is community involvement is a really big one in terms of the community being involved in creating the shared vision for downtown development. Demand is a big one. Making sure that there is demand for what you're thinking about. And then that primary contact, at least one person wakes up every day thinking about this project to keep it moving forward. So basically, this assessment helps communities check on the assets they have while giving them ideas for next steps they can take to become more ready. So it gives you score. The scoring is really meant to help you figure out what you have in place, what's missing, and what you can do better, and what your next steps might be. Even I think there are four thumbs up in this scoring, and even with one thumbs up, there's still investments that you can attract. So that is that. And then I just wanted to share another big piece of this playbook is this idea of the five stages of investment. And the first step is naturally planning in terms of figuring out what that project idea is, examining other community plans, doing any kind of preliminary needs analysis. And you can see some of the skills that are required to get these things done. Here, the money implications are pretty small. But then that leads into pre-development. You know, this is where more of the in-depth analysis is taking place. Financing is secured. A team is finalized. There's some more financial needs here in terms of hiring different kinds of skilled people, including architects or engineers. And then there's a make a choice place. Do you move forward as is, or do you need to step back and make changes, or does the project not really make sense to pursue? And assuming that choice is yes, let's keep going, then you'd proceed into development, which is really like getting things constructed or started up. Obviously, this is the place where the most financial need is. And this is where you'll think about project management and administrative kinds of things. And then finally, management. This is really about ongoing administration of the property. The financial implications are a bit less, but this is really about asset management and property management. And I'm going to pass it along to, I think, Amy and Alexis to kind of weigh in on how Superfund brownfields fit into this.
Yes, thanks, Melissa. So we wanted to make it really obvious for all of our listeners today where those resources that Alexis mentioned and I mentioned, the planning activities, the site reuse assessment work, where that fits into this process. And it's early. It's really in these early planning stages, to some degree pre-development, when you're trying to figure out, you know, if financially you can put all the pieces together and make this work. But this is the value that we bring, EPA brings through either our grants or a lot of our technical assistance offerings, is to help your community think through those planning activities and, you know, where is it going to take you in this spectrum of investment? And then it matters because at the later end in your development and management activities, you'll find that planning work is what set you up for success and will help you make sure, as you said before, that whatever you're planning for when it comes to contaminated property, that the site can be safely reused. So, and over the long term, as it's well managed. So I don't know, Alexis, if you had anything you wanted to add.
I don't. Thank you so
okay.
much.
Okay, thanks. So we can turn it to Shane.
Thank you so much. Oh, we have a poll first, though.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. I forgot. So, yeah, we're thinking about that community again. And what state of development is that community in?
All right, Melissa, we do have that poll. We'll quickly take it here. They are responding. And so remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is just a quick pulse to see what stage you think your community or the one that you're working with is in. For anyone who can't see the poll, you can always just type your response into a message into the Q&A. So if it's planning, pre-development, make a choice, development, or management. Or if you haven't done any yet, you can just simply type in none yet. I am seeing about 40% of the audience having responded. So we'll give it just a few more seconds to let everybody share and think about what works for them. And with that, I'll go ahead and close this poll here, about half of the audience having cast their response. And I'll close it here in 3, 2, 1. And let's take a look. So by far, it looks like about half of those who responded are in the planning stage, but about a quarter are in pre-development.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Jean.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for responding.
Okay. And now I'm going to pass it back to Shane.
Thank you so much. I'm going to advance the slide. So yeah, really, I want to share a little bit more about community involvement and engaged assessments. I think we're starting to see the intersection here of the investor that, you know, according to the poll, many of our communities and attendees are maybe lacking. Or don't have yet, the intersection of community vision / community ownership of the reuse plan or the reuse direction. And then lastly, what we just saw in the last poll, which is the fact that the majority of us are kind of in the planning phase. And so I think what I'm going to be able to share is a lot of sort of insight and resources, really as it relates to the intersection of all three of those. And I also want to highlight something that Ruthie mentioned earlier, and that's getting your local university. I'm from the University of Kentucky's Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky. It's a long title. But we are one of those organizations that really take our land grant mission at the university serious, bringing the resources of the Commonwealth of Kentucky to bear, whether that be through technical assistance or technical expertise from folks like myself who work directly with communities. And so my background is really in urban planning and you know, I always joke that I'm a rural-based urban planner, but for many of our small communities, that's the case. We we have these beautiful historic communities that are in rural communities. But what I want to share first is sort of our distillation of planning / brownfield redevelopment. I think when we think about downtown revitalization, we start with community engagement. We try to identify the issues, assess what our futures may be as we move into redevelopment planning and evaluate those findings, and then start to sort of think about what investments we may need to bring to bear in our communities to move into action. But the thing that I really want to remind everyone is that uncertainty in each of these sections really is a harbinger of risk. And we know that risk can be a deal breaker. Risk can prevent investors from feeling very open with their financial resources. Risk can make community members a little weary of getting engaged. But at all of these nodes, risk creates uncertainty, and uncertainty really reduces our sort of initiative to move those planning processes forward. It can be a deal killer. But how do we move forward? How do we get above that? Well, we like to think, get your community involved from the beginning. Obviously, when we get engaged early and often, it helps drive that long-term vision. We see a lot more success, and we see community ownership. Whatever that use is, whatever that demand is, again, that connects that vision with the investor risk. If an investor knows that a community has prioritized a particular use or particular thing, it reduces the uncertainty and the risk for them. We know that when we engage early and often, the resulting use of that plan often reflects the real world needs of that community. And the other thing that we have found in particular in Eastern Kentucky is that through our community engagement, we often help establish and identify new team members, folks who sort of step forward, who have a very strong desire to get involved or to move things forward. So in fact, not only are we helping create the vision, create community ownership, but our community engagement and involvement often helps us identify the team and those certain champions that shepherd that process through to implementation. Oops, excuse me, sorry about that. But again, you know, the benefits of involvement, I can't stress this enough, that the more we sort of have these opportunities of engagement, the more ownership of ideas that come out of that engagement. When we have better data, and this is going to go back to what I'll share in a little bit, we use engaged assessments a lot. It's kind of citizen science of the planning world. We want people to get involved to own data, to create or generate data, to help tell the stories. It helps us focus on what matters most. This also helps us sort of think about in the future as we start to do resource road mapping or capital stacking, figuring out what resources and financial leveraging needs to happen. But then the other externality here is that when we know sort of what data we have, what matters, what the community owns, it helps us really focus on engagement and outreach strategies, that the other piece of community involvement. Okay. But, you know, when we talk about outreach and engagement, sometimes we use those synonymously. And I just want to remind ourselves here that they're kind of two different things, that outreach really is kind of a short-term communication where we as an organization may be sharing data that's collected to inform. It's really directional, one way, kind of a transaction, where community engagement, on the other hand, really is a long-term process that we use to establish and build relationships, determine what we can accomplish collectively or together, determine how the entire community can benefit. And ultimately, it's a cyclical process where we are connecting through a variety of topics and concepts and opportunities to discover. So I want to sort of jump into this a little bit and just sort of share a checklist, if you will, as you're sort of engaging and beginning brownfield engagement with your community. These are some certain lessons that you may want to take note of. It's okay to acknowledge historical decision-making processes that may have created distrust. Acknowledge, be transparent, address it, face it, address those barriers to participation, whether it be food around dinner time or childcare, transportation. Make sure you focus on the underrepresented voices in your community. Who hasn't been invited to the table? And be thoughtful about where that table is, about where your meeting location is or the timing. Try to listen more than you speak. And make sure that your processes reflect your principles as an organization or as a collective effort. I really want to hammer this point of be creative, have fun. So much community engagement happens in formal spaces that people just don't feel excited to join, whether we're talking public forums or big meetings in formal spaces that are stuffy. Be creative and try to have fun in the way you're collecting and gathering input. And I'm going to share some examples of how we have really approached creative engagement, right? These are a couple examples that I love to share. You know, one of the best is make an event of it. Make a family fun event. Bring food, bring partners, get some underwriters or some sponsors. And I'll share a specific example a little bit later about one that was radically successful. I'm also going to talk about a radical walking tour. We love walking inventories. You know, there is something different about navigating your community at 2 miles per hour as opposed to 25 miles per hour doing windshield surveys. So we love getting on the street. We love doing mapping exercises. Those building inventories are obviously critical to brownfield redevelopment, but don't forget the narrative, the community narrative of place, whether you're doing storytelling or story circle or ripple effect mapping, sort of getting a sense of how people have connected in time. We also love photo affinity. You know, what does it look like or what do we want it to look like, whether we're using community photographs or otherwise. But also the idea of pop-up opportunities, whether you're doing tactical urbanism or sometimes we have had students do virtual reality. and essentially recreate downtowns in a virtual reality landscape, and allow those elected leaders and other decision makers to experience that that environment virtually. But then lastly, the Chalk and Talk, which is another pop-up idea that I will share momentarily that we love, love, love. So, you know, let's think about this idea of the building inventory. I want to share just an example of a really successful building inventory that took place in Harlan, Kentucky, far southeast Kentucky. This was an engaged assessment. A lot of people got on the streets to inventory their building. They had this sense that the entire town was abandoned, derelict, boarded up, vacant. But what they did is they challenged the notion, the narrative. And what they realized was that the entire downtown wasn't vacant, but just a very high concentration in one block was. And it just so happened to be the block that was the entryway. So it was what you saw when you came into town. It allowed them to focus on a specific geographic area. But when we do these sort of building inventories and engaged assessments, it really allows us to prioritize our intervention based on what we find, whether that's your phase ones or phase twos, or doing some additional engagement or tactical urbanism, some pop-ups. But the Harlan team, you know, they created this map using simple Google screenshots, little polygons. They inventoried the buildings. They inventoried the building characteristics, and they communicated with the property owners. And this is the part that I loved. They called those property owners in as opposed to calling them out in the process. We have a long sort of sometimes misunderstood history in Eastern Kentucky where building owners are considered absentee. Maybe they don't live in the community or active. And that was the sense here. Now, many of them still lived in the state. They were still close by, but I've added this sentence that has lingered with me since this project. And this team wrote a letter to each of these building owners and said, you know, we have a vision to reinvigorate our downtown. And we can only do that through building partnerships with property owners like yourself. And this is my favorite part, who hold the keys to our downtown's future. There's just something sort of metaphysical and completely tangible about holding the keys to a downtown future. And building owners do that. But as a result, you know, they did a number of inventories. They collected all the information that they could. These are just an example of the types of data that they were collecting. But most importantly, what they did is they created an event and they told the story of these buildings. They created narratives. They touched on nostalgic history, why that building was important. And over the course of an evening, they held an open house and they invited the public, investors, real estate folks, all of those potential team meetings or team members to join in the event. They did an open house, toured all of these buildings where the building owners had received that letter and agreed to participate in this program. And through the course of that, not only did they sort of share the importance and the priority of the community, but they were able to entice investors and folks to move these properties forward. Right now, it is nearly impossible to find a downtown building that is available in Harlan, Kentucky. The other resources that I want to share with you are the Rural Placemaking Toolkit. This is a resource that SEDEC, the organization that I work for at the university, created in partnership with the USDA. Now, rural placemaking is a hot topic right now, and really what we're talking about is how can we creatively create places for people? And when I think about downtowns, I often say that the indicator species for a downtown are humans, and that we need to create places for people, and that investment will come once these places are people ready. But I want to highlight a couple of these, the first being the Chalk and Talk. Working in rural communities, we never saw the before I die chalkboards that were very popular in big cities. So we decided to create one. We prototyped it. And essentially what we created was a three-sided chalkboard. You see the prototype on the right. And we would take them out and pop them up at community festivals. And we essentially asked folks their opinions. We had them tell us, you know, what they'd like to see next time they were in town, what brought them to town, what their visions for the future were. And throughout the day, they would share their ideas. Kids would often get engaged because it gave them a sense to be a little more creative. And throughout the day, we would document. And once the board got full, we would erase. And at the end of the event, we would catalog everything. We would start to code all of the responses and provide a report. And this is a great way to sort of get feedback without anyone having to commit to act. It's kind of the low-hanging fruit of visioning, where folks are really able to share at their own speed and on their own time without having to commit themselves to any kind of follow-up. But this kind of lingers in the ethos and the conversation of the community as that visioning and further engagement starts to take place. We have a great guide available on ruralplacemaking.com where you can download this guide. It tells you how to put this together, how to build it, how to analyze it, and how to facilitate that experience in your own community. Another example is what we call the radical walking tour. Again, I said I love experiencing a downtown at 2 miles per hour as opposed to 25. And this exercise is a great way to kind of to have those conversations. So again, we ask folks to join us to walk their community. This is really an exploration of all your senses. What's it like to see, to hear, to smell the information that you are being exposed to in your downtown, in your physical environment? Again, on the ruralplacemaking.com, you can download the entire toolkit to facilitate your own radical walking tour. It includes sort of guiding questions, activities, a survey to help your participants sort of move along. But again, this is a great way to start to establish sort of existing assets and the way that your community may be looking at your downtown in its present state as a way to infer what those future uses could be. And then this is another example that I love. Again, I said, you know, humans are the indicator species of your downtown. The more humans you see, the more healthy your community is. This is Harlan again. They did a project called Where Your Sidewalk Begins. And you can see all of these people pushing carts. And you may be wondering, like, why are they pushing, you know, AV carts or loading carts? Well, Harlan has some challenges with pedestrian infrastructure and pedestrian accessibility. And there is no better way to get your local elected leaders or your other officials, your decision makers, to understand that deficiency than to have them push something with wheels through that community, whether it be a baby carriage, someone in a wheelchair, someone with other mobility issues, where those sidewalk infrastructures can make or break your experience. Or even make or break your willingness to visit that community. So they spent an entire day pushing these carts around their town, identifying and mapping and inventory places where pedestrian infrastructure investments needed to take place. And again, this is the social fabric that surrounds the individual buildings. And if folks can't traverse around those sites or buildings, again, that is uncertainty and risk for someone looking to invest money in that building. And then sort of moving here lastly, we have to engage the youth. We have to engage children in rural communities. The narrative is often our kids are leaving. How can we bring them back? But rarely do we ask them what kind of community they want to come back to. So again, as a part of that ruralplacemaking.com resource, there is this great exercise developed by the University of Wisconsin. It's a great guide. It helps you sort of talk through and work through with young children thinking about what they love about their town. And it is hard for folks in leadership positions to not take what the children say strongly, right? I mean, you can't overlook the children. When we all know that we are building and making these investments in our downtowns for this generation. So, you know, again, engage early, engage often, make it a fun. And then this is that great family event that I was involved with Ruthie and others in Wayland, Kentucky. This was in a historic school, lots of partners, lots of food. I mean, we're talking 77 participants in a town that has a population of 403. That is a pretty remarkable return. They went out, the Vistas, the AmeriCorps Vistas that were supporting this, went out and did door-to-door invitations. They did surveys on site. They gave out gift cards, $10 gift cards to every attendee. And this was really focused on supporting and working through and engaging the community around a flood recovery and redevelopment plan. There were kids' activities. And as a result, not only did they receive feedback on sort of flood mitigation and cleanup and downtown revitalization, business and job planning, but they also recruited a dozen new volunteers for this effort. For a dozen volunteers in a town of 403 is a huge, huge piece of human capital. So again, invest in engagement early and often. Think of investing in engagement as your early investment before you even start to think about grants and financing. So, you know, lastly here, you know, I know many of you are engaging already. You're doing some kind of engagement with your community. And I commend you. But I want to remind you that it's not a this or that. It's rather a and that too. Do it all. Do as much community engagement early, often. You know, there are ways to engage your community that are just as diverse as the problems that we're trying to solve, and just as diverse and complicated as the people who call our communities home. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ruthie to continue and talk a little bit more. Thank you.
Thank you, Shane. I just want to encourage everyone to please go to that Rural Placemaking Toolkit. I was so excited when Shane agreed to share this with you guys, because there are so many amazing tools that can really help you to creatively engage your community and really build some trust with community members and recruit volunteers to help. Because I know in a lot of rural areas, it's so hard. It's always the same people doing the same thing. So it's great when you can engage people and get new people involved. So now we come to the point, and we're going to talk about money. So you guys learned about how to, you know, get your team together, how to engage the community, all the different stages. And now it's the money time. And so I know probably a lot of you are like, finally, this is why we're here. And some of you are probably scared. I know as a grant writer, I love just, you know, writing and stories. And so when I first started writing grants, I hated budgets. I hated having to think about the money behind things. I wanted to focus on the story behind things. And when I realized that a budget is the financial story of that story, then it helped me to really come to love the numbers. And so I encourage you, if you're scared of numbers, read this investment playbook. We use very basic language. It'll help you to understand these things so that you can really take ownership of those numbers, take ownership of all the different types of money you're going to have to stack together to make these big, amazing projects happen. Otherwise, they won't move forward. So now we're going to talk about money. Let's first talk about what investors are looking for. So this right here is a spectrum of financial return. So basically what this is it's showing the types of risk that an investor is willing to take on. So it's the different expectations that they have for their risk and their return. So if an investor has a greater risk, they're going to want a higher return. If they're giving you a bigger grant, they're going to want a higher social return. They're going to want more jobs created, whatever that thing is that they care about. Or if the other end of the spectrum, if they have a bigger risk financially, let's say they're investing a few million dollars into a new startup business, then they're hoping that that is really going to take off and they're really going to win big financially, right? So you can see left grants all the way through forgivable loans, repaying loans where you just repay the principal only. Then it starts being more focused on the financial return of having a financial return with a little bit less of the market value, and then a full market rate, and then the risk adjusted market rate. So just wanted to kind of preface that financial return and the risk involved for different investors to help you understand what investors are looking for. So you might have never seen anything like this before. That's okay. It's called a capital stack. And we've identified five different parts of the capital stack. So what a capital stack is it's basically a snapshot in time of all the different types of money that you're putting together for a project, right? So you're going to have in here, it outlines who gets paid and when they're going to get paid. So you'll see on the bottom, there's grants and subsidies. Those are not repaid. Then there's above that is the credit enhancement. And those are really just ways to help move the financing forward. And then the next part is subordinated debt. And that's going to be the second one repaid. And the first repaid is above that. That's the senior debt. And then equity is the last repaid. And I'm going to go into these in more detail to give you some examples. But I highly recommend read that part of the investment playbook. It'll take you 10 to 15 minutes, and it'll really help you understand all the different types of money that could be sitting on the table that you're not putting into your project that could be helping you to make it move forward faster. Because gone are the days when one grant is probably going to fund an entire project, especially with construction increasing. There's a lot of issues. So let's talk about grants first, though. Grants and subsidies and technical assistance. So there's different types of these. These are the things that you do not have to repay. First, you have catalytic capital, which can be like planning grants to help you think about it, maybe involve the community in planning something, get some technical assistance. Then there's non-repayable funding. These might be like crowdfunding campaigns that you can do, or there's also technical assistance. And so this might not be funding. This might just be someone offering their services to help with planning activities. Then there's local donations, like you can have tax revenue. For instance, lots of places have a hotel or restaurant tax, and so you can get funding that way. And the last is tax credits. And I put an asterisk by this because I told you that a capital stack is a snapshot in time. So sometimes tax credit seems like they are a grant. And sometimes if you're looking at it after the fact or before the fact, then it can be in a different category. So we'll go into that a little bit. But tax credit examples could be historic tax credits for properties on the National Historic Register or new market tax credits and low-income housing tax credits. So I wanted to take a minute and just let Amy and Alexis talk about some of the things that Brownfields and Superfund can help you with for that bottom layer of the capital stack.
I'll go first really fast. Thanks, Ruthie. Yes, so we wanted to take this opportunity to point out the technical assistance pieces that Ruthie were talking about. EPA's Brownfields program has a lot of technical assistance available, and it is for planning activities, again, to work through how to safely reuse brownfield sites. You can talk to your regional EPA regional staff, Brownfields program staff, to learn more about those different opportunities. And then we also have other technical assistance and grant opportunities. In fact, the assessment grant opportunity that you see on the slide, that opportunity is open right now. So take a look at that and I'll pass it to you, Alexis.
Thanks, Amy. Yeah, and just really quickly to add on the Superfund side of the house, in terms of technical assistance for planning, that reuse planning that we talked about and that you're going to get to hopefully hear a case study about a little later on, is that first row for us. And that's a good place to look for the reuse planning support. But as Amy mentioned, we also have, you know, regional folks in that are serving all the states and territories across the country. And so if you do want to reach out to them for somebody that might have be more in tune with the particulars of the sites that in your part of the country, you can look at that bottom cell that says local technical assistance. And we have a coordinator in each region. You guys are going to meet one of them later on. His name's Tom Bloom from the Midwest, but we have folks everywhere and they're happy to hear from you. So I think with that, should we pass it back to Ruthie? Okay, thanks.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Alexis and Amy. So those are just really great ways to help you with that, you know, first stack, part of the capital stack. You know, what are some ways that you could right now really invest in planning activities and get your capital stack moving forward? So let's take a poll. Tell me, have you taken advantage of these resources in your community? And if so, which ones? So you can answer Brownfield or Superfund or both or not yet.
Right. This is Jean. Just a quick report here. About a third of the audience has responded, almost up to 40%. I'll just give the audience a few more seconds here to share their thoughts, and then we'll close this poll on and carry on in the interest of time, because we want to hear from a few other speakers and make sure there's plenty of time for Q&A. So let me go ahead and just kindly ask you to share your thoughts and then hit that submit button, and we'll close the poll here in 3, 2, 1. And as I display those results, about half of the audience shared input, and more than half of you have not taken advantage of them. But those that have, about a third of those individuals responded that they have taken advantage of brownfield resources in their communities.
That's great. I'm glad folks have, some of you have used them, and if not, some of y'all know that they exist now. So we'll move on to the next part of the capital stack. And I think this is one of the least utilized because a lot of people don't know that these things exist. So the next is credit enhancement. And so this is really used to help you gain other types of financing. So for instance, a loan guarantee, this one can help you get the financing that you need. It's kind of like having a co-signer so that a foundation can step in and pay a missed payment if you miss a payment, right? So it's kind of like if you're going to default on your payment, then that foundation can help guarantee that loan. The next is a loan loss reserve. And that can be a fund where a bank can like then dip into that fund if the payment is late. So it's really good at helping lenders kind of accept the high risk of a really risky project, right? And then the next is tax credits. I mentioned sometimes it's like a grant if it's after the project, and in the beginning, it's kind of like a credit enhancement, because really tax credits are helping you kind of entice investors to come to the table because they know that after all said and done, they'll be able to have a really good return on their investment because of that tax credit. And then the next one is subordinated debt. And that is basically a way for investors to have a lower financial return for a bigger social impact. So a lot of times this might be something like a bridge loan. So an investor might go ahead and give some funding up front. Like if you've gotten a grant, but it's not going to come in yet. So they could like fund some of the pieces up front. And then whenever the grant comes in, they can have it be reimbursed, that kind of thing. Also philanthropic local impact investments. So one really good example of this was in Hazard, Kentucky. They were redoing their old Greyhound bus station downtown to become an art station. And while they were doing it, they just didn't have enough money to get it all done. And so a local foundation offered them an impact investment that basically it was like a loan where if they made their payments without missing a single one over 5 years, then part of that was actually forgiven. So it really gave them incentive to always make their payments and to be able to raise funding for those payments. And the next is recoverable grants. So sometimes this could be an agreement that you would make to pay back the loan in different payments. And that is so that they could be re-granting that to other people. And then the other one is concessionary local investments. So a really cool example of this was in Princeton, West Virginia. And there's a case study about this in the playbook. But basically, there was an investor who really cared about their community. So they bought this old dilapidated building and they let members of the community buy pieces of it. I think there might have been about 30 different people in the community who bought pieces of this building. And for $50 a month, they would eventually own it. And so they got to invest their sweat equity. And it was a really cool way to get people who wouldn't normally invest to be able to come together and really make this building something amazing that they could share. Then the next one is senior debt. And so a lot of you are probably familiar with this. This is usually conventional debt, like what you might see with a bank, with financing, just normal repayable loans where you know how much your interest is, so you know how much your payments are going to be. But it can also be different types of innovative lending. So one really cool example that I know of is called crowd match loans. And the Mountain Association in Eastern Kentucky uses this. And so basically, instead of having to have really good credit, a small business could do a crowdfunding campaign, and whatever they raise in crowdfunding, then they could use that as collateral for a loan. So they could match that. Other things that people sometimes do are just if you allow someone paying their bills frequently to count as showing that they have good credit, that kind of thing. Then there's a bond and a mortgage. And I think most people know pretty much what those are. We pay mortgages for a house. There's like a typical way that you repay that. And the top one is equity. And so this one is going to be the last repaid. And so because of that, folks who have equity really want to get a good financial return on their investment. So examples of equity might be traditional equity, like purchasing a part of a company and then expecting to be paid a percentage of all the revenue. There's also angel investors who they can be supporting new startups. There's community equity, which usually kind of invites people in the community to also invest so that it's not just the normal wealthy investors, it's people in the community as well. And then there's venture capital, which is usually for startup companies because they think that there's going to be really high growth potential for that. So I hope that helps you understand what all the different types of new capital could look like and that you got some ideas of things that you can start adding to your capital stack for your project. So let's take a poll and then we're going to get to some really cool stories where some panelists are going to share real projects that have really happened. So the poll is think of what that community again. What types of new capital should you seek to attract now? So grants and technical assistance or subsidies, credit enhancement, subordinated debt, senior debt, or equity. Which one are you going to focus on attracting now?
All right. Again, it looks like the audience has got the swing of it. They are sharing their responses now. If you have any difficulties with that poll window, you can always type in a response into the Q&A and we'll catch it there. It does look like about a third of the audience has responded and there is a clear trend as I'm looking at these early results. And I think, again, just in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and close this poll out here in 3, 2, 1. And let's take a quick look at those results. About 40% of you shared your thoughts and overwhelmingly 2/3 indicated that you're now looking at grant, technical assistance, or subsidy new capital in that community. But a number of you are still also exploring credit enhancement, equity, or subordinated debt.
Great, thank you, Jean. So let's move on to our case studies and hear about some real stories that have really happened. So I'd like to invite Ray Moeller to talk about the Bluefield, West Virginia project.
Yeah, good afternoon. Happy to take you on a little trip to Bluefield, West Virginia. Bluefield used to be a prominent city, intersection of train traffic and coal community. And like a lot of communities, rural in West Virginia, hard hit in the last number of decades. And they've got a pretty energetic economic development director, Jim Spencer. He contacted me. I run a downtown Appalachia redevelopment initiative, which brings some of that preliminary early pre-development technical assistance to projects to try and get them off the ground, move the needle just a little bit. And Jim contacted me about the Hawley building. And you're looking at the Hawley building from the outside. That's Jim and I fist bumping when the city decided to actually take on this project. And that was the inside of the Hawley building on the right. And Jim described it pretty aptly when he said this building smelled like a wet dog. And there's a lot of interesting aspects to this project, but I'll point out just a few. The city had an EPA assessment grant, which they were using in multiple sites. They were able to utilize that in assessing this building for asbestos and lead paint and any other environmental activity. So there was an EPA aspect to it. Our Downtown Appalachia program brought some early technical assistance to have an architect show us whether or not this building was architecturally sound and ready and could take a next redevelopment. It had sat empty for a little while. The last business in it, as you can see, was an open mic cafe type building or a business. And so we proved the building was on good legs. The bones were solid in spite of the look of it. And right about the same time, the local hospital closed down in Bluefield, and folks were going to have to go to the next city over, which was Princeton, mentioned earlier, for a lot of their medical services. A local clinic was looking for a new space or to expand their services in response to that, and they were going to build on green space outside of town. Jim contacted them, had them take a look at the building. They were a little bit hesitant, as you can imagine, in looking at this building. But then we were able to get a second round of technical assistance and show them how the clinic could fit into the space that we had had analyzed by an architect. And they were very pleased with this ground floor layout that allowed it to be a walk-in clinic. And then the upper floors could be used for more extensive services, group counseling and foods and other program activities related to the clinic services that they wanted to expand upon. And so they agreed to go ahead and take this project on. And Jim worked out with a local foundation to address the remediation of the asbestos that was found in this building, because it was not to the extent where an EPA grant would be required to successfully deal with that. So there's just a lot of creative aspects and resources that went into this project. Jim Spencer, as the EDA director, was the spotter. He's a good man for engaging folks into the city's resources and assets. It was a team effort in framing this up. I worked with Jim, the architect that we engaged, worked with Jim. And Jim and I both engaged locally and around the state. And the developer ended up being the Bluestone Health Clinic. They were a federally qualified health clinic, which made the financing just a lot more straightforward once we got through the pre-development work. And our architect that we brought into play here became kind of the developer contact to carry this project forward. Like I mentioned, there was a couple of strategic investments from the Downtown Appalachia, giving the architectural analysis and the final drawings. The EPA assessment grant helped analyze it. The Downtown Appalachia follow-up proposal showed that the clinic could work there. A local foundation dealt with remediation, and then the federally qualified health clinic funding allowed them to take on the redevelopment. But there's nothing better than showing you the result of this kind of work. A year and a half after I engaged with Jim, I was able to attend the grand opening of the Bluestone Health Clinic on Main Street, Bluefield. Instead of being something that you'd have to drive to, people can walk to it. There's a lot of parking adjacent to it. You can see the beautiful waiting room that folks get to sit in. And in the course of bringing this back to life, it was uncovered that there was a skylight that had been covered up years ago. And the architect uncovered that skylight and created the ability to have natural light feed down into the clinic waiting space back by the health clinic rooms. And the before and after, you can see the exterior. You saw that earlier. In the exterior, they freshened it up and made a nice asset addition to Main Street Bluefield. And on the interior, just about exactly where we were looking at the wet dog building basement, it now looks like this at the bottom of that skylight. And so we're very proud. This is our poster child for Downtown Appalachia, and we are glad to have brought this building back to life. Again, strategically engaging, like has been laid out throughout this seminar, this webinar, and glad to be able to bring the Hawley building from Bluefield, now the Bluestone Health Clinic, to the table. And I will hand off to to talk about the paper mill. Yes, Tom Bloom.
There we go. Excellent. So, Tom, I'm going to swap the view over to you. Thank you so much, Ray. And Tom, feel free.
Okay. Well, this is Tom Bloom. I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator in Region 5. I'm also the Repowering America's Land Initiative Coordinator there, too. So I work with a lot of renewable energy projects. I'm excited to be here to show how Superfund, and more specifically the Superfund Redevelopment Program, can help and play a vital role in supporting revitalization of rural downtown communities. We're here to help with ideas, resources, technical support, and best practices. And if you have a Superfund site, we'd love to help you out and hear about it. I'm going to use our time today very quickly to just talk about a small rural community that transformed their downtown area by integrating all seven of the underlying principles of the playbook into the redevelopment efforts. Those principles are flexibility, communities lead, better together, care for rural assets, investing in the long haul, skin in the game, and building community wealth. Next slide, please, Jean. Plainwell, Michigan is a small town with a population of about 4,000, an area of about 2.2 square miles. It's a rural town that speaks to the playbook principle of caring for our rural assets. It was a paper mill that operated throughout the 1900s and closed in 2000. The property is along the Kalamazoo River, and it's part of a larger Superfund site, which includes 80 miles of the Kalamazoo River, 3 miles of Portage Creek. Let's see, they also have 5 landfills and this paper mill as part of the Kalamazoo River site. The site was added to the National Priorities List in 1990. The paper mill area is 36 acres, which is 3 times the size of the central district, this business district in Plainwell. It's got a long history of paper production in the Kalamazoo Valley. While Plainwell is not the first paper mill, it's the only one that remains reasonably intact. Paper production in the 1990s contaminated the soil and river sediments with polychlorinated biphenyls, posing risk to human health and the environment. The loss of the paper mill had a direct economic impact in the community. While in operation, the paper mill accounted for 18% of the city's total taxable value. And I wanted everybody to kind of take a look in the bottom right picture. On both bottom right pictures, there's a building in the very bottom right corner picture. It's the administration building right there. Yeah, you've got your pointer on it. And that was partially rehabilitated before the paper mill moved out. That'll come up later. Next slide, please, Gene. So from the day the mill closed, the city of Plainwell knew that something had to be done. The mill was a huge part of the downtown area. City manager Eric Wilson saw that this would be a good opportunity if we could move into the site and do it successfully. The city staff and elected officials reached out to EPA's Region 5 Superfund Redevelopment Program with some support for community-based reuse planning. I was the reuse coordinator back then in 2004, went out to the site and was part of this process. And I remember Eric Wilson, the city manager, bringing up the fact that this partially renovated building was sitting right next door to where their city offices were. And their city offices were kind of co-located in the back of a Walgreens. And while Eric was saying, what do you think it's going to take for us to move into this really nice administration building that's walking distance from where we're at right now? And I said, I don't know. I'm not sure what it's going to take, but we'll try to get there sooner or later one day. Can I have the next slide, please? Well, the city of Plainwell established partnerships with EPA, the state environmental regulatory agencies, Weyerhaeuser, that was the responsible party there. And we formed a mill committee. The mill committee had 32 members. They were community residents, local elected officials, business owners, city of Plainwell staff, site owner representatives, and representatives from the community, like the organizations like the Plainwell Rotary Club. We met over 9 months. We researched the property's history, assessed local land use trends, market conditions, and developed the reuse guidelines and a reuse strategy for the paper mill property. That was the site's first reuse plan was finalized in 2005. And I remember it was really unique to have these brainstorming sessions with all the people there, then coming back the next week or so and refining the ideas that they had, getting a consensus-driven like reuse plan together. And then we all presented it to the public. The mill committee presented it to the general public. And it was really good because it wasn't just EPA going out and exchanging information. It was the community members that were coming out and exchanging information with the rest of the general community. Can I have, let's see. Okay, so here up on the slide here, we've got the community goals were set. These are the community goals that were set in the finalized reuse plan. And the reuse plan had a conceptual framework where we could switch things in and out that would also help to attract developers and could be referenced in the remedial design phase of EPA's work. It's kind of important, if you can, to begin the reuse planning process as early as possible in the EPA's Superfund cleanup pipeline, because it's good to get the community goals and plans that can be accounted for when EPA does their cleanup investigations and feasibility studies and records of decisions. The city then acquired the property in 2006. They completed a phase one and phase two environmental baseline assessment, which allowed them to pursue bona fide purchaser, prospective purchaser status, and that helped them with liability issues. Next slide, please, Jane. So the city got energized. The city staff started attending regional and national meetings and conferences to raise the property's profile and attract interest to the mill. They started seeking out developers who were private sector development partners with experience in mixed use, historic preservation, and also with Superfund site cleanup. They hosted a developers forum. They wanted to see how the project looked from the private sector's point of view, and they took the feedback from that developers forum and hosted another public workshop with the community. And they had a couple of public workshops, and they used those public workshops to update and refine the reuse plan. And that's not unusual for some of our Superfund sites, where we get momentum going, we get the community up, we get a reuse plan together, and momentum kind of falls off for a little bit. And a couple of years later, somebody comes back, takes that plan off the shelf. It's not a waste of time. They re-energize that plan, re-engage everybody out there, and we move forward and get something done. So I like a lot of times our project managers will get discouraged after we go through a great big process like this and nothing happens, but it's not for naught. It'll be coming up in the future, and it was value added to make the process move forward. Next slide, team. The city also worked on a request for a proposal for prospective developers. In 2008, they issued a RFQ nationally, and following interviews in springs of 2009, they picked Conestoga Rovers and Associates, an international environmental consulting firm and development company. They emerged as the leading candidate. CRA is a specialized developer that works with Superfund sites. They had the necessary expertise to execute and support the cleanup in the project. And once with the developer secured, things started happening. They invested $2.4 million to upgrade that partially rehab building. They added 50 more jobs. They rehabbed the common area that invited people in to have offices there. So that was nice. And they also they partnered with the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, which helped out even later on, just recently, with a grant. Next slide, please. Okay, here's our players. The city manager is probably Eric Wilson. He was the champion that had come to me and wanted things to happen. Our redevelopment program and I were kind of the facilitator and the framer. We came and said we can't help you with a Brownfields grant or a grant, but we can help you with in-kind services. Our consultants can come out, hold meetings, put things together. And that's what happened. The engager was the city manager, EPA's community involvement coordinators, and also EPA's reuse consultant, which at that time was called Ecology and Economics Squared, E2E Squared Inc. Now they're called SKEO Solutions. The developer was definitely the city and Conestoga Rover. They had the most play in the game. And the primary contact was Eric Wilson. He was on board all the time. You could call him. He was totally dedicated to making this thing happen. Next slide, please. So here's our capital stack, and we see that there's a $2.4 million equity investment put in there by CRA. We also see where some of the money came from. A lot of this money came from grants, and that made it happen. And with some of these DEQ grants or the development grants, EPA sometimes would have to write a little memo saying, hey, we've got the site in our queue, and we're making it protective. Kind of help out the recipient of the grant with a little, not a letter of recommendation, but just a letter letting the people that are issuing the grant know that EPA is on board with what's happening out there. And so that kind of made things happen there pretty well. Next slide, please. Try to wrap it up real quick here. It's success. It's paying off. Phase two of the demolition was completed in 2022. and that was completed with a $5.1 million grant from the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and the property is now available for development, even more of the property now. The paper mill is an example of how the community, when community leaders, collaborative partners with like the EPA and the state agencies and local reuse stakeholders, can produce a detailed, flexible, long-term planning process, and it can result in a couple of really good successful outcomes. One is protection of human health and the environment, and two is community revitalization. Property now supports commercial, public service, civic, recreational uses. The business is on site. There's a headquarters for a commercial construction company. The city got to move their public safety department over into the mill property. There's a donut shop and a restaurant. Residents and visitors can access the Kalamazoo River for recreation purposes by going through the property. There's walking trails around and near the river. The property is now on the National Register for Historic Places. And as of October 22nd of this year, EPA's economic data showed that there's 127 people employed there, and they're generating over $26 million in annual sales revenue. So this really is a cool success story. We had to stick with it for a long time and not get discouraged, but we finally, everybody got it to happen, and I'm very proud to be part of it. Now I'm going to hand it over to Alexis for more information.
Thank you, Tom. I love that story. Thank you so much. That is so cool. And so cool that you got to be a part of it. And thank you, Ray and Shane. Go to the next slide. Just wrapping up here, we want you to know how to find us. So this slide has a lot of text on it, but feel free to jot down the email address or phone number of somebody that you'd like to reach out to. And please do note under my and Amy's contact information, both at the top there, there are links to our programs so that you can find out more information about what is happening, what's available. Amy mentioned there's a grant, available right now for people to submit proposals to. And for our planning resources, they're available all the time. So reach out, find the Tom Bloom in your region. You'll be lucky. They're all wonderful, just like Tom. And thank you so much to, Ruthie and Melissa for including us and letting us highlight this amazing playbook, and to Shane and Ray for sharing their expertise. It's been such a great session. We are happy to take some questions now for a little bit. So let's see how we can, where do we start? Amy and I will kind of moderate them and pass them on to folks. Let me make sure. Oh, yep. And if you need a prompt as you're thinking about it, we'll take your questions, but also we'd love to hear from you. The point of this is, just to learn from each other and take that time to do that. So these are some things that we'd love to hear from you about. And in the meantime, Amy and I will field some questions that have come in. If you have any others, just open that Q&A little cartoon box there, cartoon bubble there, and just type in your question. Thank you.
Thanks, Alexis. Mm-hmm. And thanks to all our speakers. We got such a great group and with lots to share. And I know we have had almost everybody stick with us over this webinar. So thanks, everybody, for your time. So like Alexis said, we do want to hear from you. We would love for you to answer some of the questions that you're seeing under the Share Your Story, because we know that you all have your own unique experiences with this. So while you're thinking about those three questions on there under Share Your Story, we did have a few questions come in through the Q&A pod while the speakers were starting. So how about I do the first one, Alexis? And then it's the first question that came in says, where does remediation fall into the five stages of investment? So probably midway through, we talked about planning, pre-development, make a decision, the development process, and then the management process. Those were the five stages. So who would like to tackle the question about where do you find remediation?
Go ahead.
Sorry, I typed in an answer. I guess I wasn't supposed to do that, but the remediation in the experience I've had through our Brownfield office and through the Downtown Appalachia program is that it could be considered pre-development if you're trying to get a site ready for next level consideration, or it can be part of the development cost of the project if you have to incorporate that into sort of the long range plan. If you can swing an EPA grant to get that cleanup and remediation taken care of, then that adds some time to the project. So it's kind of a value proposition, and a lot of people come at it from all different angles.
Thanks. And I'll add really quick from the Superfund perspective. Yeah, sometimes those things can happen kind of concurrently. I was just visiting a site in Norfolk, Virginia last week where there was remediation in the form of a cap that was going over a layer of soil that would make the site protective and also some groundwater treatment. And that happened because they had done the reuse planning. That happened kind of, they were able to do it to the developer's specifications. So that's kind of a neat story that when you do the planning ahead of time and you work closely with the EPA folks that are planning the remediation, sometimes there are opportunities, not always, but sometimes there are opportunities to take advantage of that work that's being done to remediate property that also can kind of feed into advancing the development. So there's lots of stories about that. And I think Amy, do you want me to do the next question?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Okay, somebody on here is interested in knowing about that specific. My ears perked up too, Ruthie, when you were mentioning that example about the location of the building. So I don't know if you need to say that now, but you can maybe just point people to if that was somewhere in the playbook that they should look. I don't know if you can recommend specific projects, but.
Yeah, well, it was mentioned in the Princeton, West Virginia case study in the playbook. It doesn't go into super like a bunch of detail, but one of the main people who was responsible for that was one of the authors of the playbook, Barbara Wyckoff. And you can look her up. She has Dynamica Consulting and Coaching, as well as a business called Creative Disruptors. So that would be a good place for you to find more information.
Great. Thank you.
Excellent. We're getting a lot more questions and even right now. So people keep sending them in. Thank you, attendees. And also, if you want to answer any of the three questions that we have, the prompts from the slide in the Q&A, that's fine too. We're happy to share those out. Okay, so the next question I saw goes to Shane. You were talking about tactical urbanism, and the question was, is tactical urbanism, are those approaches any different in rural settings versus urban settings?
You know, the way we approach it is it's not that different. I think the scale is different in terms of sort of maybe the square blocks of an urban environment that you're working with. You know, when we're working in a small community in Eastern Kentucky, it may be 15 square blocks. It may be 4 square blocks that represents the entire downtown. So most certainly scale is different. But when we're thinking about the principles behind it, you know, we want to test something. It's a short-term application. We just want to see how it does, if it's something we may want to make deeper investments in. I think principality, it's not that different, but I think the big difference simply is the scale to which they may be deployed or implemented. That's sort of the way I think about it. You know, like I said, I joke that I'm an urban planner in a rural community or in rural communities, and the built environment is the built environment. It's the sort of scale that's a little different.
Great. Thank you. And Shane, while you are on camera, why don't you stay there for a sec? Because we have another question that I'm hoping you can talk with us about navigating uncooperative council members.
This one is tricky. I think we all have faced this in the past, whether we want to admit it or not. And we have a number of communities who have experienced great success in spite of their local elected officials, whether we're talking mayors, county administrators, or city council. What we often suggest and the way we approach this is the community is our sort of primary party, and that's what we're more interested in. And that sometimes we have to sort of utilize the system permits or the processes at hand to create things. And oftentimes they're test cases. Maybe it's a local festival or something like that. And we have to achieve undeniable success. And the reason that I say undeniable is that we're talking the sort of success that people are talking about or that are getting attention. We have had cases where, for example, we worked with a community. There was a small green space. A local mayor and city council wanted to turn it into a parking lot. I have an adversarial relationship with downtown parking in a lot of ways. So did the local community. They wanted that site to remain a green space. They created a, in spite of their local leader support, they created a local festival. They held a successful event. It got on the newspaper. It got in the news. It was undeniable in its success. There were food trucks. They were serving alcohol. Adults and families and kids were all having fun. People were talking about it. And guess who had to come around as a supporter or look like they were kind of the community's wet blanket, not wanting folks to have fun? And that were those elected officials. It's certainly the case around election time in rural communities. So when you can band together and create something that has undeniable and observable success and that people are talking about it, many times those elected officials are forced to join on board. But when they are creating obstacles or sort of railroading you, creating challenges or administrative burdens, that's kind of a different thing that often requires a little bit more engagement, a little bit more sort of ground truthing and data and exposing them to like the true community vision to try to get them to move off of some position that they may hold. Some folks may, some people won't. Humans are complex. We're all a little different in terms of what we are looking for or willing to listen to. But in general, we often recommend moving forward in spite and creating something that is undeniably successful, and they will often come along.
Can't deny success. Thank you, Shane. Okay, I saw another question in our list here that I wanted to bring up. Somebody shared that they noticed that in the Plainwell example, the city manager was the key player holding several of the positions. And they're wondering, is that wise? And I actually think this is probably more of a question for Melissa and Ruthie, since one of you did talk about how sometimes in small towns, you don't have enough people to fill every slot in your five key player roles. And so sometimes someone has to do double duty. So could one of you talk about that a little bit?
Sorry, I saw Melissa shaking her head. So I thought you were about to jump in. Yeah, absolutely. So definitely, I know I work in a lot of small towns, and there's sometimes one person doing almost everything, sometimes just a few. So yeah, absolutely. You should try to get more people involved. And a lot of that community engagement, whenever you start, you know, trying to have public meetings and things like that, trying to have do new, exciting, creative ways to engage people. If you go to that role placemaking toolkit and find something new, you might get some new people to get involved in the team. But if it doesn't happen and you want it to move forward, sometimes it is going to have to be just the city manager. But I do want to point out that I'm pretty sure it wasn't just the city manager doing it, although that was what was on there. It was probably his whole office. And so he probably had a secretary and just different people on his team who were helping him. Because you're right, it is really hard to do a big project like that all by yourself. So definitely try to get more people. But if it's just one, it's a small town, that's okay.
we tried to help him out there too. I mean, we had our community involvement coordinators. We didn't ask him to hold a public meeting. We just said, where can we have the public meeting? We'll show up with all the people, help us to get them in the room together like that. So it's right. Eric was doing a lot of stuff because he didn't have a big planning department underneath him or anything like that. But I was trying to help make his job as easy as I could.
I was also going to say, I know I agree completely. I think in rural communities and small towns, there are the same 10 people who do everything. But I think thinking about unlikely, kind of unusual partners is where you might go when you have that issue, is like, again, thinking about the outcomes you're looking for and who else might care. Like, you might find some interesting partners that you hadn't thought about. And you can see some of that in the case studies in the playbook, that there are some kind of unusual partners, whether it's a college or a school or a hospital, or, you know, there are, or even just other businesses that care about improving the downtown. So, yeah.
Thanks. And I'll add one more thing and then go to the next question, is just that I think, you know, to echo everybody who said, yes, great to diversify when you can, but also just to work with the reality of the situation. And also, it's really good to have your local government, you know, your officials, your manager involved in these things, because ultimately the community can create their vision for reuse, but you do want to have your local government as an important partner there. So that can also be really helpful. Okay, there's another question that came in that I wanted to address, and I can talk about the Superfund side, but maybe others can address the brownfield side. But asking about, will the EPA allow municipal government owners, so landowners, to transfer the ownership of properties to a nonprofit, and what are the constraints or considerations? So I'll just say for the Superfund side, yeah, EPA is... we are, you know, we don't own Superfund properties. We do not get to control in terms of like what happens with their transfer. One thing that we could do, so yes, a government could certainly transfer the ownership to a nonprofit. The consideration with, you know, any property changing hands that's been part of the Superfund program is liability and also maintaining protectiveness. And so we have, you know, site attorneys, we have folks like Tom that will engage with people that are wanting to potentially purchase or acquire a Superfund property. And we have actually a great handout on our website called the Top 10 Questions to Ask before buying a Superfund site. And so, you know, there are a lot of things in place that will help address some of those liability concerns. And then also making sure that whoever is owning and, you know, managing the property is doing so with, you know, protection of human health and the environment in mind. So some of these Superfund remedies are really carefully designed, and they're all specific to the place. So, you know, those people just have to know about them and make sure that they are not, you know, disturbing the remedy. But it doesn't have to be that complicated. It does happen all the time, and EPA is there to kind of help figure out what exactly that means and help you sort that out in terms of what liabilities there or are not there. So I don't know for the brownfield sides, if anybody wanted to add anything.
I will quickly, and then I'm going to ask Ray to chime in. So same situation, EPA doesn't own brownfield sites. We're not part of local government decisions around what to do with your property. But we want everyone on this webinar to make sure you are protected from liability, that you do have those liability defenses, and that you don't accept any property without having those liability defenses in hand. And Ray, I was going to turn to you because I feel like your organization as a technical assistance provider does a really good job of getting the message out about, you know, how to protect yourself from liability.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. Our organization made up T-shirts to give out at our state conference, asking, "Have you had a Phase One? And you need to get that Phase One environmental assessment if you're a municipality or a nonprofit or someone who's being gifted, or you know, somebody wants to convey a property that's been has a mysterious past, please do not even consider accepting that without getting the phase one that again helps provide that liability, addresses the liability concern, and then allows you to qualify for EPA cleanup grant funding if you need that.
Thanks, Ray. Alexis, is it my turn to ask a question?
I lost track for a second.
I think
maybe
so
this
too.
Will be the last one.
Yeah, and we haven't seen any of your ideas come through. So if you, it's not too late, if you do have a partner that you've worked with who we didn't talk about today, please let us know in the Q&A. And if you have a favorite community engagement strategy or something that worked really well that you didn't hear about today, or even if you did hear about it today, like please, please let us know. We want to spread this information widely and learn from all of your experiences. So with that, I don't know if we're going to get to all of our questions here, but there's one that I think is really important because it addresses burnout when it comes to planning and the length of time that these projects can take. And so the question is, do you have any tips on how to keep the community and local officials engaged for the long haul? There's excitement around a spark and getting things started, but how do you keep it going to get through all the years that it takes to see these sites through? Who wants to take that one?
I'll start. I think the first bit is being absolutely transparent in what the expectations and the timeline are, what each quarter looks like. Create a Gantt chart. Celebrate it. Every accomplishment, no matter how big or small, is something to celebrate. Keep the energy around celebration, commending yourself, celebrating other folks' contributions. But I think it starts with being transparent and very accountable up front. And if things go off rails or off track, be accountable, be transparent, own that, and own the solution that brings people back together. Those are the two keys, the two pieces to that for me, at least.
Thanks, Shane. Does anybody else want to?
Yeah, I was going to say, this is Tom Bloom. I was going to say sometimes, carving off a piece and showing some small progression. You know, if you have an overall holistic idea, a plan on how to do something, sometimes if you can determine what can be done sooner than later and phasing it. And so the community sees, oh, there's something happening on that site, and it's just not the guys in the white suits doing the cleanup. There's actually people putting some foundations down or doing some things like that. So a lot of times it's hard to do that, but we try to, you know, have some little success that we can move forward with, and that keeps the community engaged after we do the planning process. Yeah, you can carve out and just have something happen, even like we were talking, like a barbecue out at the site or something like that, announcing that it's cleaned up and things like that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like move to implementation as soon as you can. Okay, Alexis, I think we can sneak out one or two more questions.
You think so? I know Jean has some closing.
Okay.
Closing stuff that she has to do. I want to make sure we get everybody out of here as promised by three. But I do want to mention that I saw in the question and answer that there are a couple folks that had several questions that we didn't get to address. So please feel free to reach out. Please really do, because you know it sounds like you're interested in talking about this more in some of the details, and we really would love to hear from you. And yeah, thank you. That's great. And yeah, if you haven't, I know there was a particular question for Shane in there about creative community engagement. So, you know, please do feel free to reach out to us. That's why we're here. And thanks for joining and staying active in the dialogue here. Again, I guess on behalf of Amy and I, I'll just thank everybody one more time. And, you know, thank you so much folks working on the playbook and sharing case studies from around the country. We're just really privileged to be able to kind of share this with all the folks that work with us on Superfund and Brownfields. And we know that this is going to be a big boon for all the work that they're trying to do in their communities and, you know, keep everybody hopeful and inspired. And so we really appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, I will take it away here with just a few final reminders. I want to echo Alexis's gratitude to all of the presenters, the organizers, the support team on in the background, along with the live audience who joined us from all over the world. Just a quick reminder, we encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org. We are always posting new information related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. And I encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month, and I'll announce free online training such as today's session. If you weren't here at the beginning, just a gentle reminder, the presentation materials, including links to download the playback and the assessment tests, along with a variety of other resources, including presenter contact information, all of that is currently posted on the seminar homepage. So that URL is shown in red on this slide. It was also in the reminder and confirmation email, so you can reference one of those. And you can bookmark that page so that you can reference it after today. It will remain active. On that seminar feedback page, pardon me, on the seminar homepage, there are various sections. You may need to scroll up and down to find the content that you're looking for. What I want to draw your attention to is the feedback form. There is a section just for the feedback form. It's almost near the bottom. And if you fill out that feedback form, that is how you can request a participation certificate. While I don't issue CEUs or PDHs, I can give you a participation certificate with information about our session, date, time, links to more information. So if you're looking for documentation of your attendance, please fill out that feedback form. Make sure you check the box at the bottom of the feedback form, certifying you were here for the whole thing. And then as soon as you submit your feedback form, you'll have a window where you can either download, print it, or save it for your own records. We will email a copy of the form to you, but sometimes those get caught by junk or spam filters. So I always encourage people to download it or print it out from that confirmation screen. And if you happen to host a viewing party in your location, so you invited other colleagues to join, you can actually share the link to the seminar homepage with anyone who sat in with you, and they can fill out the feedback form to get their own participation certificate, even if they didn't register individually. So I'll just kindly ask anyone who hosted a watch party, please share that link to the seminar homepage so people can share their thoughts with us. Now, today's session was recorded. You will automatically get an email from me when that recording is available for on-demand playback. And again, the seminar homepage will be available, shown in red on this slide, from today forward, so you can share that with others. And for those of you who happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded webinar, if you've made it to this point in the archive, right about now in the archive, there'll be a button above my head that'll take you over to that feedback form. And you can also share your thoughts on the session based on your replay of the archive and get your own certificate, as long as you check the box confirming you watched the entire recording session. So with that, again, one big great thank you to all of you who joined us either in setting up today's session, hosting it, or attending. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and you'll join us on a future session. With that, it is my pleasure to go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.